You are listening to the Regent College Podcast.
Hi, I'm Rachel Hanna.
And I'm Claire Perini.
And welcome to the Regent College Podcast.
Today we had a conversation on the podcast with Dr. Quentin Janus. And Quentin is an emergency physician here in Vancouver. And he's taught at Regent before in J-term of 2024. And he's going to be coming again to teach the same class, Healthcare and the Christian Life. So today we chatted to him about some of the themes of the course, big topics, death and dying, addiction, medical assistance in dying.
Yep.
And just heard some of his stories from working at St. Paul's, the hospital in the downtown east side. Just his real passion to see every patient as a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like he says it sort of at different points, but it's this drumbeat that underlies everything that he's thinking about, particularly these things that are complicated and human experiences and all of those sorts of things, and just seeing everyone as a person and therefore no different to him or no different from you and I, kind of when things are complicated or there's other issues going on. Quentin has this like beautiful ability to speak with dignity about other humans and the kind of his vocation of compassion and how he understands that. And so should you ever find yourself in an emergency in Vancouver, I would just try and make sure that you get yourself to St. Paul's and make sure that Quentin is on that day. That's a frivolous way to talk about it, but it was a great conversation. And yeah, he walks through a whole bunch of things, as Rachel said. So let me give you a little bit more of a sense of who Quentin is. As Rachel said, he's a physician at St. Paul's Hospital in the emergency department and a physician ethicist for Providence Healthcare. He holds a Master of Letters in Theology from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and his research is focused on bioethics. His academic interests include palliative care, end-of-life care, biomedical ethics, personal autonomy, addiction, and theology. He's the author of a forthcoming book on addiction and the church, which he talks a little bit about, which is fascinating in the ways that he's thinking about that topic in particular, given the work that he's doing in Vancouver. And he's also, as Rachel said, has taught classes at Regent before, and he's teaching in the summer here from June 9th to 13th, a class called Healthcare and the Christian Life. So, friends, we hope you enjoy our conversation with Dr. Quentin Janus. Quentin, welcome to the Regent podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You sound like you're a bit of a podcast aficionado. Is that the right phrase? That you've been on a few?
I have been on a few. As I was saying, most of them, you know, have somewhere between 5 and 10 listeners. Four of the five are my mom.
You know what, my brother, I always say this, my brother will add at least one to this one. So there'll be at least one person listening, maybe my parents, maybe one of someone Rachel knows might listen as well. Yeah. Maybe, and get your mum to listen a few times.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for being with us. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your kind of medical career, and then a little bit about what it's like working in the emergency department at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver?
Yes. So I'm an emergency physician. I'm originally an Alberta boy. But I moved out to British Columbia after med school. So I did undergrad in Edmonton, med school in Edmonton. I did a master's of theology in Scotland, sort of in the middle of med school.
As one does.
And then I moved out to Victoria initially for residency and then to Vancouver for my emergency medicine year after my general practitioner residency that I did in Victoria. And then we never left. It was our initial plan not to stay in Vancouver, but some combination of things that has a lot to do with St. Paul's caused us to stay in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy we did. So now it's been about 5 years since I graduated. Mm-hmm. So I now have a couple of jobs. My first sort of day job, or my 4 a.m. job, as I like to say, is that I'm an emergency doc at St. Paul's. For some of your listeners who might not know about St. Paul's is the very large academic hospital. It's a downtown hospital in Vancouver. And a lot of our identity and our vision and mission is driven by our relationship with the downtown east side of Vancouver. So my emergency medicine practice is still a lot of bread and butter emergency medicine, a lot of stitches and pulling things out of kids' ears and kind of the normal stuff. But a lot of what I do also has to do with downtown east side, a lot of mental health, a lot of addictions, a lot of violence in our department. And it is work that is both incredibly challenging and incredibly rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it that aspect of St. Paul's that made you stay? You said there was something about St. Paul's that made you stay in Vancouver. Is it that aspect of the medicine? And is it?
I would say it is. St. Paul's is a very funny place. Mm. And it just is a very human place at the intersection of all of us have cracks. So all of us are frail. Mm. And yet human beings are such beautiful things.
Mm.
And there are spaces in life that are what some people call thin spaces, where you perceive the holy and the beautiful very close at hand. Sometimes it's difficult to bear those things.
Yeah.
Those things feel heavy. And yet when we encounter those spaces, we want to be in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find the juxtapositions that are present at St. Paul's, a lot of horror, but a lot of holiness, those juxtapositions are present everywhere. They're present in each of us. And at St. Paul's, they're maybe just more apparent than in a lot of other places. And so it's an endless challenge to develop the vision necessary to see those things,
mm-hmm.
the humility necessary to recognize them in people who are very different from me, and the creativity to know how to, I don't know, sort of fan those things into flame a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think it's that challenge that constantly pulls me along.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So what are some of the key issues you find yourself facing in your work as a doctor, and how do you integrate those with your faith?
I feel very blessed to have a vocation as a physician.
Mm-hmm.
I wrestled a lot in my years of education with what I wanted to do with my life. There was big chunks of time where I didn't want to do the medical thing, and I just wanted to pursue theology or the academy.
Mm-hmm.
But from where I sit now, I'm so grateful that the Lord called me to sort of keep going, even though I grumbled a lot during the process. And I love the practice of medicine. I love the ability in the emergency department to meet strangers all the time. I meet 30 odd strangers every day and then try to develop trust with them. And some of them who do have emergent medical problems have to make very high stakes decisions under a lot of pressure together. Mm. And there's real cognitive, interpersonal, creative challenges associated with that. I think the biggest struggle of my vocation, like many Christian vocations, has to do with encountering suffering in other persons.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful, of course, to belong to a faith tradition that has deep wells of resources that don't see suffering as a simple question to answer, but neither sees it as an embarrassing problem to be avoided, like is so common in our society, but presents suffering as this mystery that should compel a certain kind of a presence. And so in that sense, I would say my faith doesn't set me free from that struggle. If anything, it forces me more into it.
Yeah.
But does so in a way that that brings perseverance and hope. In the midst of it.
Yeah. What has sustained you and kind of allowed you to persevere? And kind of is it just Christian faith, or is it certain aspects of Christian faith that kind of allows you to persevere and be hopeful in the presence of such deep suffering?
I do think that one big aspect of Christian faith is the aspect of hope. And that can sound very glib, but I do think that one thing that I commonly say to myself and that I pray when I drive to work down Hastings Street is I say to myself, even on the downtown east side, all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. Even on the downtown east side, all tears will be wiped away. And so I believe I work with people who are all full of moral rebellion. We believe things should be different.
Yes. Yeah.
And sometimes people are told the cure for that is to move into this kind of stoicism, to sort of put to bed your moral rebellion just by this kind of distance, to say, well, things are the way they are.
Mm.
And I actually think the Lord blesses our moral rebellion, and that we shouldn't try to, you know, come to some stoic distant place where we don't care. But I think a key for a Christian is that our belief that things should be different is matched by a promise that things will be different.
Right.
That it isn't just my one little voice screaming in a sea of empty blackness, but that my little voice is by grace, part of God's work, not mm-hmm. my work, but God's work of mm-hmm. mending things that seem unmendable to us.
Yeah.
So I think hope is the first word I would want to say. Another maybe sort of cold comfort answer to your question is the Christian sobering truth that the Christian life is a life of compassion, and compassion means co-suffering. Mm. And I think that in med school, I feel like when people talked about things like burnout or compassion fatigue or the ways that encountering suffering can be difficult, we were told in many ways, implicit and explicit, that success in having a long career or a productive career was found if you could find a way not to suffer. If you could, again, find the right kind of professional distance,
right.
do enough box breathing or mindfulness exercises or those kinds of things, to find, again, just that right stance where you're close enough to the patient where they can perceive empathy from you, but far enough that you're not yourself muddied or
right.
burned or scarred by their mm-hmm. suffering. And I think trying to occupy that stance of distance is actually caused a lot of burnout, because people buy into this model that says, I should be able to occupy this space without suffering. And if I suffer and grieve, that's a kind of failure of my right. professional distance. And so they aspire to be deadened. They aspire to be unfeeling. And then that actually is far more depersonalizing in the long run and unhealthy, I think, emotionally and spiritually. So I think my faith frees me to start from a very different place, mm-hmm. to say becoming close to suffering people means inviting suffering into your own life, and coming close to grieving people should provoke grief.
Right.
Of course, like, for that matter, who would want a physician who could see a patient die in front of them and then just whistle down the hallway? Like, there's something so, even aside from a Christian worldview, there's something quite unappealing.
Yeah,
about
sort of dehumanizing.
But I think, in doing it for a few years now, I think Christianity tells me the truth that my vocation is a compassionate one. Part of real compassion means suffering and grief. And so I shouldn't aspire to a kind of professional distance that frees me from being scarred, but rather I should accept that at times I will be scarred by the work I do. And then to believe this beautiful truth that Christ's hands have scars on them. And so the power of God to beautify, to glorify even our own wounds and our scars is our hope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. People who have listened to the intro to the podcast will know that I lost my mom to brain cancer 2 years ago. Just over 2 years ago. And I just remember that feeling of going into hospital rooms and sitting with doctors and feeling like I was talking to a robot almost. Yeah. And it was her specialist nurse who was always the person who I would call if I was just needing somebody to talk to. And often there were no answers. Like, it was an awful situation, and it was just like banging your head against a wall in terms of access to support, because it was during the pandemic. And but I remember when she died, which actually happened quite suddenly and unexpectedly, this nurse called me the morning of her funeral, and she said, I saw your mommy's name in the Funeral Times, which is this kind of Northern Irish thing where funerals are advertised. And she said, and I thought, is that my Linda?
Wow. Mm.
Ooh.
And it just felt like, oh, like, she was a real person to you. And it's just amazing, like, the impact that had on me in that moment of just like, oh, my mom wasn't just another
another body
object, you know, to you. But yeah, it's amazing how isolating it can be when you interact with physicians and you are just kind of seen as not really a person.
Yeah.
Which relates, I think, to the next question, which is about, you know, dignity. And maybe it's not something people think about in the patient-doctor relationship, but it's a term that's used a lot in kind of ethical decisions around healthcare, both from Christian and humanist perspectives. So you've thought a bit about, you know, theological anthropology and human dignity, and how is that informing your understanding of, you know, what dignity means?
Yeah, first I just want to say thanks for sharing your story. And I often am so struck in my own work about how we see patients in extreme circumstances. And you might think, looking at them, nothing we can do is gonna change this. Like the last shift I worked, I saw just a tragic accident of a young person who was killed just going out with his friends, total like no one did anything wrong, just like this kind of one in a million thing. And his friends were brought in by EHS, these young men who were just grieving. And you might look externally and say, like, I can't change this. Nothing I can do will make this better or worse. This is just this horrible grief. But the heavy truth is that I can make it worse. In one way, I can't.
Yeah.
But the way you treat people in moments like that, they will never forget. Yeah. And that is it's an opportunity. It's also a challenge. And when they, like you, at times perceive that you're distant and you don't show care, you can grieve and wound them in ways that are very deep. But then the flip side of that coin is when you take the time to show that, even without being able to understand, you know, because the person who died is a stranger to you or someone you didn't know very well, but if you can show them care, then people will also never forget the way you treat them. So that's an opportunity. And I think the language of personhood as well as the language of dignity are very important to me. And when talking about almost any medical ethical issue, one of the first things I always want to say is it's a person, it's a person, it's a person, it's a person. And actually from a Christian perspective, or at least from sort of my articulation of that, you can get through a lot of content if you just stubbornly insist they're a person, they have personal dignity, and then just slowly work out what that means across the human life cycle in all kinds of different ages and stages and different disease processes. The language of dignity is very interesting to me because it's an interesting symptom. Like, there's this word that is used in totally opposite ways by people with different perspectives, and the different ways that the term dignity is used reveals very different worldviews in our time and history that are in tension. And so the one view of dignity sees dignity as maybe sort of nice sounding rhetoric, but really that points to the notion of autonomy. And this view of human beings says what gives us value is our capacity, the things we can do, our ability to be independent, to assert ourselves, to have the capacity for, you know, relationality with other people. And another view of dignity, which for me is the sort of theological view of dignity, says dignity does not come from anything we do or have the capacity to do, but dignity comes to us from outside of ourselves. Dignity is grounded in what we are as God's creatures. And so where if we ground dignity, you have dignity because you can communicate or because you can, all of those things can be taken away, and then suggest things that are essentially ableist about human persons who don't have those capacities, and suggest, however implicitly, that those persons matter less. And for me, the only way to a equal and from my perspective, a high view of dignity is to say that dignity, personal dignity, is this immutable phenomenon that is grounded in what we are. And the beautiful thing about that is that that is guaranteed by God himself, and that no state of dementia or prematurity in a baby or chronic illness or whatnot can rob a person of that. And this has huge direct implications on how we care for persons. And even in our time, I often feel like the mantra of suffering people is, I don't want to be a burden. Like, how many times do I hear people, especially as they get older, saying in medical settings over and over again, I don't want to be a burden. And there's a wonderful essay by Gilbert Mailander, who's a great bioethicist, who's been here at Regent recently, actually. But he wrote an essay in, I think, the 90s. Don't quote me on that, where he says, why I want to be a burden on my children, which is just a wonderful inversion of that burdensomeness. But a Christian view of dignity stubbornly asserts that persons are not burdens. Right. Like, persons always come to us as a gift. And for me, the Bible is insistent upon that. Persons of all stripes, whether they come to us as refugees or widows or premature children or elderly persons with dementia. They are first a gift. They are a neighbor. They are a person who stands equidistant to God from me. And as such, they deserve my respect. And why I should respect them is not grounded in anything they can or can't do, but again, in what they are.
Yeah, I keep thinking about what you said. It's a person, it's a person, it's a person. And part of the, like, what it means to be a person is that you don't stay alive. Like, that death is inevitable and that, like, that somehow is inherent in the kind of being a person. And, you know, death is not something we talk easily about kind of in culture or in even in the church. Even though we talk about a Christ who died, we don't always, we're not always great at talking about our own death, maybe in the same way. Can you, what do you have any thoughts on kind of like, how do we think about death and dying? What does a good death look like? How do you, as a person, as a human, you know?
It is a, someone recently, someone who I know who's an adult Christian, been a Christian for a long time, came up to me and said, oh, Quentin, I know you're interested in this nerdy medical ethics stuff. And he was saying he's wrestling, his grandparents are getting older, with some of the questions about dying. And he said, if only there was like a really clear historical example of someone who died in a way that we as Christians could really plant our flag on and try to exemplify. And again, without wanting to criticize anyone, I just, it makes me want to poke out my eyes with pins, you know, because like our faith is concretely grounded in this historical event of a someone who is fully human like you or I, who died in a certain kind of a way, and whose conduct in the midst of walking through the valley of the shadow of death produced amazing goods, the greatest goods of anything. And so even when Paul in Philippians 2 tells us to have the same mind as Christ, and that wonderful hymn of the early church where he describes Christ who was high, who empties himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And then, of course, in the second half of that hymn, you see Christ exalted again. Paul is giving us, I think, concrete exhortation. This isn't just vague sort of spiritualizing. I think there's ethical instruction there that says, what should our stance be? What should our mind be when we approach these things? So I think the first thing that you've already pointed to in terms of a Christian view of good dying is not to be people who ignore or euphemize about the reality that we are creatures who die. And one of the challenges we face in our society, and there's been a lot written about this, is ours is a culture that is medicalized and that has denied death. And whereas 100 years ago, the average story, people would die at home, children would grow up caring for, witnessing family members, community members, when they themselves were suffering and dying. And those things were seen as, of course, tragic, but part of the life of communities, of social, religious, cultural spaces. Now death has been cast as a narrowly medical event and is hidden from view wherever possible. And even the way people speak about death, even in medical settings when people are dying, people use euphemisms like passing away or they're gone or those kinds of things. And this is where there is a ultimately kind, but in some sense hard edge to Christian truth that tells us we should plainly speak what is true, that our hope is not to make an idol of life and to cling to life at all costs as if we are gods and not creatures. We are embodied creatures who are utterly dependent on God to sustain our being and whose the trajectory of our natural lives universally ends in death. And so an initial step to promoting a good death is simply to being a space that doesn't participate in saying it's only narrowly a medical event, or sidelining it, or or denying it through these nice sounding but ultimately misleading terms. One of my heroes in these kinds of conversations is a palliative care doctor named Leonie Herx, and she says we should ourselves and teach our children how to use the D words, dying, death, dead. And again, not in an unkind way if I'm dealing with a patient, but to simply tell the truth about what is. Another thing, obviously it's a broad question in terms of what promotes good dying, but I do think recognizing the season of death and dying as one that can be full of meaning. And I think one of the tragedies of the way that our society has pushed death away is that many people have never recognized that. They've never sat beside the bed of a loved one who's dying and found themselves in the really vulnerable, deeply human conversations that happen around those beds, the reconciliation that can happen, the even the reminiscing, the way that a person can think about their own legacy or can pass on knowledge or advice or those things to others. Those moments are, again, those thin spaces.
Yeah.
They're incredibly, incredibly difficult moments. But I think most people I know who've occupied those spaces would say they're some of the most significant moments of their lives. And so our society tells a narrative that once you're dying, you can no longer be autonomous. You can no longer do enjoyable activities. So your life is essentially over.
Mm.
And Christians should have the patient gaze to look at that time when a person is dying and say, what are the ways the Lord can bring beautiful things from their lives that can bless themselves, bless others? And so to see that space as full of significance and from which, you know, flowers can bloom right. And then the church needs to do the costly individual work of setting up networks of mutual dependence where people who are dying can have visitors and can have someone to come take them for a walk or come sit beside them and read to them or those kinds of things. And certainly if our neighbors and loved ones and friends who are dying are by themselves in a room with just a TV and strangers in masks, it's going to be very hard to perceive those goods arising.
Yeah.
They need people to surround them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just thinking about, you know, that your vision and then the reality of, you know, medical assistance in dying and how it's like two very different narratives about what end of life should look like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So could you share a little bit about medical assistance in dying and where is that at now in terms of the legislation and kind of the daily work of physicians?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an area, there's certainly conversations throughout the Western world going around about this, and Canada was a relatively early adopter of this practice. And as a brief headline without getting up on my soapbox completely, I find the language of medical assistance in dying to be sort of imprecise and misleading language. And I would want to say that physicians for thousands of years, Christian physicians for centuries have been medically assisting patients who are dying without acting with intent to end their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really would want to resist any dichotomy between, on one hand, you're assisting the dying, and on the other hand, you're, I don't know, doing nothing or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so the distinction here is about the particular practice of acting with intent to end innocent life. I'm not that old. I'm 33. But when I started med school, this practice was illegal in Canada. Someone would it would be seen as a egregious professionally and ethically and morally and even legally for someone to do this. And I think it is a monumental cultural shift that has happened in less than 10 years.
Yeah.
Since 2017, that maybe many people haven't noticed that much, but it is for me quite a distinct shift. I think at the root of it, I know this isn't totally hitting your question right in the middle, but at the root of it, there is a fundamental question again of how we perceive dying and the goods of dying. And I think it is notable that outside of Christian societies, the act of acting with intent to end one's own life, with or without the assistance of another person, has been a reasonably common answer to the question of what is the right way to die. But since the earliest centuries of the church, there's been in my view, fairly consistent theological answer from the church that is not the answer that Christians should take.
Mm.
And again, there's a lot I could say about this, but in brief, firstly, because our lives belong to God. And because, again, even from the earliest centuries, the command not to kill includes the command not to intend the death of any innocent person, including yourself. But secondly, grounded in the positive example of Jesus, who did not seize control but who gave himself up over to the care of others and the care of the Father at the end. One thing that's interesting about death and dying in our context is there are some people in our context who want to cling to life at all costs. You know, right. they stay in the ICU as long as possible, much beyond when there's any capacity for meaningful recovery. But what really matters to them is this clinging to life. And then there's an increasing number of people who are dying via this practice that we now call MAID. You might think that those are the two sort of opposite poles. From my perspective, those really are two sides of the same coin. And that coin is autonomy. It says, yeah. What makes for a good death is my control, yeah. is me being able to assert what I want, even beyond when I'm conscious enough or whatnot to do so. But it's about the endurance of my control. Mm. And the Christian answer about what really matters at the end is couldn't be more different from that, from my perspective. Mm. There are certainly ways of enhancing people's agency that recognizes their dignity and it is good. Mm-hmm. But at root, again, the model of Christ says what matters at the end is not, again, that like clinging to what is owed to us, what we think it is mm-hmm. owed to us, but rather the willingness to give ourselves over to the care of others and to the care of God. So in a context where this practice that's commonly called medical assistance and dying is increasingly common, I think there's real opportunities for Christians mm-hmm. To carefully think through what we're called to in terms of loving our neighbor, helping them see that they're not a burden and that God can still bring about goods in their life, even when they have a life-limiting condition. And also for Christians to engage our minds to think carefully about how we conceive of goods at the mm-hmm. end.
Yeah, and so as a Christian physician, how much freedom do you have to act out of those places of conviction that might be at odds with kind of what's accepted or what, you know, what can be asked of you kind of in a medical situation? Like, so what are the implications of, can you say no, I don't want to do that? Like, what are the implications for those who hold faith and are wrestling with these kinds of issues? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's differences in some different jurisdictions. Certainly in Canada, no physician would be compelled to perform that.
Yeah.
Even calling it a procedure makes me a bit itchy, but no physician would be compelled to do that if they didn't want to do it. In some jurisdictions, in some provinces, physicians are required by the college to provide what's called an elective referral, and that's certainly a subject of some debate. But to my knowledge, and according to the guidelines, certainly a physician would always have the ability with something like that to say, I don't want to be involved in that and to not be involved in that, which is, what you might call conscience protection is certainly something in this context to be grateful for.
Yeah.
And I think from my own work and knowing a lot of other physicians, obviously from the work that I do as an eMERGE doc and an ethicist, there is on a lot of these issues a spectrum of different opinions among physicians. And some of my work, both on MAID and on addictions, is to try to encourage my colleagues that just because something has become legal doesn't mean we shouldn't be having good, robust conversations. Right. And we should find ways, people who share a faith tradition and people who don't, to have a good faith, earnest conversation. I can think of some physicians in my mind who, you know, let's say on addiction stuff, we're like totally eye to eye and we have the same ideas. And on the MAID stuff, we have different opinions. But the goal is, again, not to see that person as the enemy, but to foster the spaces where we can turn over what our perspectives are and then have fruitful dialogue, which, again, is sadly uncommon in our context.
Yeah.
Like people don't feel free to say, here's what I think about this. What do you think? How do we turn over these issues together? I'm grateful to say certainly in my context, there's I'm not asked to do anything that or compelled to do anything that runs against my conscience.
Mm-hmm. What did you say? Conscience protection? Is that what you called it? Or conscious? What did you? Is that what you called it?
I think like the some of this conversation revolves around like conscientious objection.
And
a conscientious objection is a conversation you know that has occurred in military settings, medical settings, all kinds of different things. Yeah. But I think there is an inherent challenge in a profession like medicine where there are some things that you would rightly say someone can't object to do that. So there's been some cases, you know, one case I'm familiar with, I don't think it was in Canada, but someone who applied to medical school and said, but I'd never want to examine a woman. Or I never want. And so I think even if they said that was rooted in their conscience, I think we'd be right to say, we're not going to make any absolute judgments on you as a person, but you can't enter into this profession if you won't do that.
Yes. Like
there are some bounds about things that you need to do in order to be part of the profession.
Yeah.
And at the same time, everyone agrees that the other boundary, there are some things that there should be difference of opinion where you, someone who believes something is right should be able to do it. And someone else whose conscience tells them differently. And the question is, where do you draw those lines?
So
it certainly would be a very dramatic shift to if you worked in a system that said you have to be willing to participate in these things to be a physician, that would be a very dramatic recasting of what a physician is.
Yeah.
That would obviously be very concerning to me.
Yeah.
And one more notable thing, sorry, I'm rambling about one interesting thing about the Hippocratic tradition. So many people are familiar about the Hippocratic with the Hippocratic Oath. Mm-hmm. And the Hippocratic tradition is this very interesting development that precedes Christianity. But in ancient Greece, there was a variety of different physician guilds. There were different kinds of physicians that did different things.
Mm.
And physicians in that time, part of what some of them would do is if someone paid them the right money, they would do things we would all consider to be horribly unethical, like experimentation or those kinds of things on human persons. And included in that was physicians would act with intent to end the life of patients. Again, the language of physicians doing this is not, or that question is not a new question. It's a very old question. And one of the things that rendered the Hippocratic physicians distinct in the Hippocratic Oath was part of their oath was never to act with intent to end life, was never to kill. And one of the reasons that the Hippocratic tradition became so popular was because for people in a society where physicians weren't guided by this ethical code, having a physician who had an oath nailed to his door that said, I won't experiment on you, I won't kill you, you know, those kinds of things was very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Hippocratic tradition did not start as the universal medical tradition. It started as a distinct guild amongst a bunch of different guilds. But it was powerful and appealing to people, especially vulnerable people, because it had some of this, the right kind of humanism about it.
Yeah.
It had a high view of human persons and their significance and wanted to do its level best, never to treat them as objects or mere bodies, but as persons who deserve respect.
Yeah.
And so all that to say, I think we still exist in the stream of the Hippocratic tradition to one degree or another.
Mm.
And I'm personally very grateful for that legacy in many ways and would want to assert that as central to what it means to be a physician.
Yeah.
Do you think like patients and their caregivers are distrustful of doctors now because of MAID, like in the sense of, is this going to be pushed on me? Have you seen that at all?
I think there are a number of very concerning stories, I think by anyone's metric, that have come up in Canada of patients who are not offered medical assistance in living, you know, who advocate for themselves or whose loved ones advocate for them to receive the care that they need to affirm their dignity, to even with just questions of ability, lifts for people, scooters or wheelchairs or those kinds of things where people are not given the support they needed, but then they're repeatedly offered medical assistance in dying as this as the solution. So I think there is a lot of conversation in the Canadian context about, you know, is there ever coercion or those kinds of things. I do think that we are seeing in our time a shift in terms of the way that medical institutions and physicians are trusted. Mm-hmm. I can see that in my own practice, even generationally, the way on average people respond to a physician is different. I think there's a number of potential players there. It's not just, you know, changes in dying. But I think that's one of the pieces that vulnerable people at times are nervous and afraid to come to medical settings because they don't know what could happen, what could be offered to them there. That's certainly something anecdotally that I've seen in my patients. and that I've heard, you know, many stories about in the work that I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does get me thinking then about addiction as well. Yeah, and yeah. kind of what people are offered in those spaces, yeah. and kind of your experience in walking alongside, helping, assisting folks that are kind of living with addiction, which obviously is devastating for people who are living with addiction, yeah. and the implications of that. How do you understand addiction, and how does that understanding shape how you think about the downtown east side in Vancouver or your medical work in Vancouver and at St. Paul's?
Mm. Yeah, addiction is currently my soapbox. So my one little plug in this podcast.
You have two soapboxes? Is there a maid soapbox next door? The addiction one, or is the addiction one the only
soapbox? My house has a huge room, which is full of
multiple boxes.
My annoying soapboxes. No, I'm currently writing a book on addiction, yeah. actually. My deadline is in a week, so I'm writing madly the next week or so. But and I don't know, a year or 2 years or something, yeah. I'll have a finished product in my hand. Because I see the conversation about addiction as so critical for our time, and one that Christians often feel nervous about engaging with, because often we're told addiction is a medical issue. It's a brain disease. And so oftentimes I know so many Christians who would love nothing more than to help, but often don't know how. Mm. And so my passion for this, as someone who works in that, is to find ways to speak about addiction that are true and that are respectful of persons. And again, my mantra is they're persons. And my favorite thing about my work at St. Paul's is my interaction with my patients from the downtown east side, and the opportunity to see the ways that their lives display the good and the beautiful in ways that are just amazing, inspiring. One of my favorite stories that I always tell when I talk about addiction, because it's so foundational for me, is that early on in my medical career, I was sitting at my desk and the triage nurse called me. This kind of thing happens all the time at St. Paul's. So this part is not sensational, but she said, there's some guy, he just registered a triage. He's pretty disorganized. He didn't even really give us a specific medical complaint, but he looks really restless and making other people nervous. So do you mind just going and seeing him right away, seeing what he needs, just, you know, so things don't get out of hand in any way? So I looked at his chart. He certainly had a violence flag on his chart and multiple prior, you know, violent incidences in the department. He had a long history of an addiction to amphetamines. And from looking a little bit at some of the recent notes, it looked like he was saying to people, I'm trying, I would like to stop using meth. And so I went to see him in the waiting room. And St. Paul's waiting room is pretty small. For such a big hospital, it's quite a small waiting room. Usually all the chairs are full, especially in the evening. And on this particular day, it was easy to see who the patient in question was, because he was sitting in the middle, and then there was this buffer of empty chairs around him, and everyone else was sort of up around the walls. He was sitting in a chair. He smelled very strongly, and his body was rocking back and forth. And sometimes he was, you know, his feet were slapping the floor, and he would, you know, slap his leg with his hand and was mumbling to himself. And he looked like a frightening person to approach initially. And I went and I sat beside him, and I put my hand on his shoulder to let him know when I was there. And in the split second before I opened my own big mouth, I happened to hear what he was saying. And I realized that he was praying, and he was saying to himself over and over again, he was saying, dear Jesus, I don't need meth. I don't need meth. I don't need meth. Dear Jesus, I don't need meth. Mm. And I was moved. I continue to be moved by just the inversion of that story, witnessing his determination in prayer, the way it consumed his effort and his body. His knowledge of his need for the Lord, his desire for the Lord, even in the context of really significant entrapment in an addiction. And I remember leaving and later that day wishing that I had asked him to pray for me, you know, in my own selfishness and smallness and those things. So this is one story to say that the first thing I always want to say about addiction is that addiction is tragic and devastating because persons matter so much, because the persons involved are so significant. And they were made by the Lord for good relationships of dependence, not independence, not autonomy, but mutual dependence with other persons, cheerful dependence on the natural world. And addiction threatens the health of all of those relationships. Yeah. It entraps people in patterns of compulsion that erode their ability to pursue the good in their life. There's a lot of things I could say about it. I think one final thing I'll just say is I think we do need in our time Christians who carefully engage their mind to answer the question, what addiction is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I think there have been for the past 30 odd years, this increasingly polarized battle between a choice model of addiction that says it's just a choice like any other choice, and a disease model of addiction that says people with addiction are just passive victims of a brain disease. They're not agents at all.
Right.
And in my view, both of those perspectives are inadequate.
Yeah.
Both of them don't have explanatory power. They miss pieces of the puzzle. But equally or more important for me, neither of them is adequately respectful of the person in suggesting that they're just some kind of degenerate or that they're just some victim of pathology. They're just diseased. Both of those separate the person from me.
Right.
Both of them say that person is somehow different from myself. And again, I'm just like banging the drum that they're a person, they're like us. And so part of the book that I'm currently writing is trying to find a middle way that tries to charitably understand the good things that each of those shallow models are looking for, but then finds a way to mediate between them and avoid their problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So can you give us a sneak peek at what that middle road is?
We don't want to be here, you know, after night falls. I think that one critical initial step in pursuing that is having the insight to say that addictions are ways of looking for good things, however fruitless they may be, however disordered they may be. At their root, they are ways of looking for things that we all want and need. And I've read over the course of the past 2 years, dozens and dozens of addiction memoirs. And this is one of the themes that stands out across all of them, even people writing memoirs from very different worldview perspectives who come to very different conclusions. I find there's often a very sad a cry at the heart of those books for the reader to see them as a person. And so people who are addicted to fentanyl so commonly say fentanyl feels like a hug. It feels like someone putting a blanket over you. It feels like drifting off to sleep in a safe place. It feels like someone giving you a mug of hot chocolate when you're out in the cold. So much language that evokes human comfort, peace. People who are addicted to alcohol so commonly say, when I didn't drink, I felt I couldn't connect with other people. I always felt like a loner, like I didn't belong. Mm. And what three beers gave me is the ability to approach another person with the ability to connect with them with a confidence that that we could find something in common or share a joke or even those little things. So I believe that if, again, we say they're just degenerate choices by, you know, people who lack self-control, or we say they're just completely unrelated, like choices that we're not able to relate to because they're just a product of disease, we miss, for me, the elephant in the room when we actually care for persons, which is their story, the good things they're seeking through addiction. And then, again, there's much more to say, but one thing about that is it immediately helps us approach persons in the right way, understanding that recovery is about replacing fruitless ways of looking for good things with fruitful ways of looking for good things. And another theme that's very common in addictions memoirs is the theme of betrayal, like alcohol betrayed me or like meth betrayed me. First using it, I felt I experienced these goods. And then I came to believe that the way to find peace, comfort, adventure, human connection, intimacy, whatever, was through this. But ultimately, it eroded those goods. It offered me those goods, and then it eroded them. And in the 12-step programs, they talk about, I drink because I'm lonely. I'm lonely because I drink. So my base problem is loneliness. Alcohol masquerades as the solution, but alcohol is really perpetuating the problem. And some of the deep sorrow and challenge of addiction is when people can see that, but they still can't stop. They see that alcohol is betraying them, and yet they can't stop behaving as if it is the way to the good thing. And so, again, this helps us see that recovery cannot be just about disease remission, as if addiction can be replaced with nothing. Recovery requires whole person care that can displace fruitless ways of looking for goods with really, truly fruitful ways of looking for goods. Mm. And so one thing I often want to say is that God wants to give you the good things you sought through alcohol. The things that you were really looking for when you went to drugs or gambling or pornography or those things, God wants to give you those good things.
So good.
Yeah, and I feel like addiction is so broad. Like I'm even thinking, you know, I've been thinking a lot about how there are these kind of respectable addictions, like, you know, workaholism or whatever.
Right.
I work because I'm lonely. I'm busy because I'm lonely, and then I'm lonely because I'm busy.
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
And like, it's kind of this vicious cycle of.
And that is one of the challenges, I'll say, that I even wrestle with in the book, is we're always torn between definitions of addiction that are too narrow and too broad.
Yeah. Like, yes.
There's the too narrow people who say it's only an addiction when it's diagnosable by a functional MRI, and it only really should, you know, cover over drugs. But that doesn't feel right to us. We can look at all kinds of behavioral patterns and see some, you know, experiential, significant phenomenological similarities. But then there's the overbroad definitions of addiction that render it sort of indistinguishable from any kind of habit.
Yeah.
And some people even, like, even there's Christian thinkers, again, in all the reading I've done, who describe themselves as to say everyone has addiction. Some people are just addicted to love and their romantic partner, or, and other people are.
Right.
And I feel like that then muddies the waters in terms of what we're talking about. And so I totally agree with you. It's so possible to be truly addicted to all kinds of things. And many of the things people can be addicted to are not bad things in themselves at all. So even something like fentanyl. Fentanyl was not an inherently evil molecule. We use fentanyl for good reasons in the hospital all the time. So the common thread is not in finding the bad things. Mm. The common thread is in this phenomenon of human beings being trapped in compulsive patterns of disordered love and then what Aristotle calls incontinent behavior, which is, again, a big conversation, but is fundamentally about something we can all relate to, which is rationally knowing that we should walk down path A and yet finding ourselves walking down path B due to some interfering factor that prevents us from pursuing what we really know is good.
Before we started, I was saying I was gonna talk about something that happened this weekend on the bus. I was just getting on the bus at my cross streets, and it's the 4 and the 14. For anyone who don't know, the 4 and the 14 are two buses that come from the downtown east side and go right to UBC. And so on Saturday, as I was getting on, there were these two guys getting off, but this big guy like pushed the other guy and then started pounding him. And there was, the bus driver was like a young woman, and she just looked terrified. And the guy pushed the other guy off the bus, and then I was kind of standing there like, I don't know what to do. So I just got on, and we were just kind of sitting there watching this fight. And I don't know if there was an addiction element to it or not, but my reaction was like, I feel scared, I feel helpless, and like, I don't know what to do. And there was part of me that was like, I just want this bus to drive away. And but the, I think their policy is to stay and wait for like the transit supervisor to come or whatever. So and my friend Laura and I were talking about it this morning, because she lives in the downtown east side, and she was just saying like, she's been amazed by how when things like that happen on the bus, like, nobody does anything. Like, people just pretend it's not happening. And I guess, like, on a very practical, like, everyday level, like we were saying, as two, you know, women, you kind of like, I don't know how, what to do here. Like, how do you engage with people as persons when you as a person feel so small and vulnerable? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's it. It's a good question. And those are really really difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. I really like, I went through a phase of reading a lot of Anabaptist theology that talks a lot about peacemaking. And one of the things that struck me about that is that one of the chief virtues for peacemakers is creativity, like is always wrestling with looking at these different unpredictable situations and figuring out how to engage creatively. And so sometimes there are situations like that that are outside of your control, and not wanting to engage in a way that's imprudent either, that, you know, puts yourself at risk without, you know, the potential for benefit. So I would want a caveat with that as well. And I would also want to fully acknowledge the environment that I work in is different from that environment in that, you know, our hospital has security staff. So I've certainly been assaulted by patients in my time, but the meaningful risk to me is less in some ways because there's backup that's close by in those situations. So I would never want to, you know, give advice from the, you know, from the perspective of not recognizing those things. One thing I have found is the real beauty and joy that part of treating people like persons is trying to rationally hold them to account for behavior. And I feel like sometimes when I started, I'm quite a soft and gentle person. I'm not a real macho emerge doc. But sometimes when patients, you know, were not behaving the best or they're a little threatening or those kinds of things, I feel like when I started, I would try to be really soft with them and sometimes probably came across maybe a bit patronizing. And I found it actually didn't work very well. Mm. And sometimes maybe was like depersonalizing or dehumanizing to the other in not addressing them rationally, but instead sort of trying to, not addressing them. And I find increasingly there's a lot of fruitfulness to addressing people cheerfully, but also sort of assertively and frankly about those things. And so I commonly, if, you know, I go see a patient and they swear at me or they say something threatening, we'll just try to say to them, hey, listen, I'm here. I really want to help you. This is why I work here. I can't do that if you're swearing at me. Can we do something different, please? And I find a lot of the time people respond really well to that when you treat them with respect by addressing them as an adult. If I met you and you started swearing at me, I would say, actually, that's not a super productive way for us to work together and recording a podcast or whatever it was. And similarly, when I go to approach a patient, we are partners in a shared project of promoting their health. So it's their health. They come to the hospital because they want to pursue their health and avoid emergencies. I come as someone who has expertise as a partner with them in pursuing their health. We can't engage in a partnership without trust. Trust is obviously undercut if there's, you know, if there's, you know, violent or aggressive behavior. And so I feel like one thing, I've learned, and even in some cases where I do some other stuff in the downtowny side where I'm not wearing my doctor hat, so I'm around that neighborhood, I've seen some stories like that. Sometimes my initial approach is to just speak loudly to the people involved and to say, hey, I'm Quentin, what's happening here? Can I help you? And just sometimes some of that element of friendly surprise, try to enter creatively, is helpful. And again, I would say sometimes it's not. And sometimes the right thing to do is to call someone else for help or if there's violence or call 911, like all those things are totally appropriate. But addressing people as persons, especially addressing adults as persons, I think can involve that kind of cheerful and kind, but also kind of direct in breaking into a situation to try to creatively knock it onto a different course.
The temptation is to depersonalize people and just kind of pretend like they're not there. I think a kind of self-protective thing.
And I do think that the bystander effect in the downtown east side is so dramatic. I recently was driving with my son, and there was a main intersection, and there was a guy who was clearly, at least to my view, had some opioids on board, who was trying to shuffle across the street but was a bit disoriented, was very hunched over, and was walking in a direction where traffic was flowing. And so I stopped my car and I turned on the flashers, and I just got outside of my car. And I went and I grabbed his shoulders and I said, hey, do you know where you are? You're on the road. But all of these other drivers are like honking at me and rolling down the windows and shouting all these things because I'm stopped. And for me, I'm it's like, this, there's a person who is here. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing this just to interrupt your day. I don't like being interrupted
in the middle of the
way. But again, there's some of this like depersonalizing thing. Mm-hmm. And again, I wouldn't want to present myself as a as an example at all. I get it wrong more than I get it right, certainly. But I think, again, like they're a person.
Mm-hmm.
Trying as Christians to live an ethic of loving your neighbor. And then
mm-hmm.
when you come to the Lord and you say, who is my neighbor? Like so often, the neighbor is that person.
Totally.
In the middle of the road, on the street corner. And oftentimes, when we take the time to go and ask that person, what's your name? The results are really beautiful and moving and stories from which all of us can learn and grow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You sound like so clear in all your thinking on all of these things. and I'm sure it's come from, you know, it's come from, like, as you say, getting it wrong and kind of trying again. So I wonder what advice would you give to people who are medical professionals, I guess, in particular, but things that have been helpful for you as you've sought to care for yourself as well as you caring for mm-hmm. others. What thoughts do you have around that?
Yeah, I love this question. And some of it I think I've already said is start from the premise that compassionate vocations will invite suffering into your life. That's true for physicians and nurses. Yeah. That's true for, you know, pastors and chaplains and all kinds of other things. So I would want to, I found it really freeing for me to start from that space. And when I'm really grieved by something that I see, or when I encounter something and feel angry, not to do the sort of repressive professional thing, but to believe that the Lord is gentle with me and therefore to be gentle with myself and to parse out, why do I feel this way? And engage some practices, journaling or talking within the bounds of confidentiality to, you know, trusted other people to explore those things. I think also it's very good for Christians of all vocations to have friends and to learn from people who have very different vocations. I think sometimes when people ask me how do you do it as a physician? Sometimes I find that question framed in a way that says, you know, there's just this like these physician specific things.
Yeah, yeah.
But oftentimes I think it's just, this is part of the reason why like rich friendships and churches of people who are so different from each other are so important. And I have my wife and I have friends who we know very well from our church who a year or two ago became pregnant and were told based on ultrasound that their child had a sort of a complex congenital vascular abnormality. And many of the outcomes were uncertain for their child. And so they were scheduled to have an induction on a Monday morning. And they drove to the hospital on that Monday morning and they hadn't set up a crib at home or brought out the baby clothes or anything like that because they knew going in that there was a chance that they wouldn't be coming home again. And I find that image just so, this such sadness and grief to a moment like that, the uncertainty and the fear and those things. But the day before that Monday morning, on Sunday morning, they were at church and I was standing in line behind them when we were going out for communion. And I was struck watching the mother as she took the body of Christ into her own body that in turn was protecting and being hospitable to the body of her child who was so frail and who no one knew but the Lord, you know, what was going to happen. And I just felt just awestruck by the power of their faith being part of the church community, their trust in the Lord's goodness in the midst of such a difficult situation. And I'm so happy to say that now they have a son who's 1 year old and is doing really well. It's really amazing. But when I struggle to know how can I be hospitable to vulnerable strangers who I encounter, how can I show grace? It actually helps me to think of them and to say, how can I set them as examples to me of hospitality, of being gracious, of bearing things they cannot bear through hope in the Lord? And then when I need to display those virtues to say, how can I be like them in, of course, a very different way? And there's ways in which I can't relate to their experience.
Right.
With all of those caveats, yes. But still to say, I would want to say to, you know, to the doctors, the nurses, the chaplains out there, if you feel isolated or lonely, you don't need to find a person who's exactly like you,
right?
To find resources to preserve your spiritual health.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, sometimes you can hear truths when they come from the mouths of persons who are very different from you, whose vocation seems superficially so different from yours, but actually who can display the same virtues in ways that can inspire you. You know, the virtue, the vocation of being a physician to a parent in my example, but in all kinds of other ways. So yeah, I would say the boring stuff like go to church, make friends with the people in your church. Don't let your church be a place where people try to put on their best face and not acknowledge their deep dependence, their wounds, the bullets they have in them, their griefs and scars, but invest in a space of meaningful interdependence and vulnerability. And then you will find your practice of medicine or whatever preserved by the witness of those brothers and sisters.
Yeah, helpful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So as we finish up, you're going to be teaching a class in June.
Yeah.
So what encouragement would you give to people listening who are thinking about it? Like, who is this class for? What would they hope to learn? Yeah, what are some of the things you'll be covering?
Yeah, I'm really excited about teaching this class. I've taught it once before at Regent in J-term last year.
I've heard people say it was their favorite class at Regent. Yeah. I've heard at least one person say that, maybe more.
Wow, that
there
is...
There you go. That just is, like, that's a strong endorsement.
It's too
anyway.
Kind, yes. Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
I love teaching it the first time. I frequently talk to my wife about just the significance of those days. I teach a lot in different settings, but there was something about this class and the people who were in it, which was very moving and enriching to me. I'm very grateful. I still am in touch with some of those students on some issues that are, you know, professional and academic, and some just got to know each other and talking about life. The class is a class that's on healthcare and the Christian life. It is intended to be accessible to people who are medical people who are wondering about my own vocation. Last time I taught it, there are some physicians, some nurses in the room. That was amazing. Mm. But it is not just for those people. Mm. Last time I taught it, most of the people were not medical people.
Mm-hmm.
They were people who were interested in asking these human questions, not just medical questions. What defines human life? What is good dying? How do we cope with suffering? What is addiction? None of these are narrow medical questions.
Mm.
And I'm grateful to my formation of having some medical practice and some theological training to maybe speak the language a bit to pull them together. But this course is intended for anyone who wants to think about issues relating to health, medicine, and healthcare, making them speak to the Christian tradition in a way that is intellectually rigorous and enriching, but again, hopefully goes along to this underlying drumbeat of like, persons matter and love your neighbor and these truths that are simple but not easy.
Mm-hmm. Man, that sounds like a great class. What's the dates for it again? June 9th, 13th? That's, that's great.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited about it. My family is actually, I'm on sabbatical for my clinical work. I get a month off of my clinical work every year. So my summer this summer is just amazing because I'm going to teach the Regent course. And then on the 15th of June, so 2 days after the course, we're flying off to Europe with all my four kids to visit a dear friend of mine and travel around Normandy and Belgium and the Netherlands. So so it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quentin, it's been so good to talk with you. I feel like one of the things I love about the podcast is like talking to people who like know a lot of things about a lot of things and then can kind of intersect them so beautifully and like kind of seamlessly to be like, yeah, that all makes perfect sense. Like the things that you're like, I don't know how to understand that. I don't know how to think about that. It's like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. So I really appreciate the way that you bring those things together and the way that you've just, helped us think about these massive questions. And I'm just going to always remember it's a person.
Yeah.
They're a person.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's my stump. Yeah, you know, totally. If I had a stump speech, it would be very boring and repetitive, but I think you can can never overdo that message in our time. But
no, totally.
Yeah, I'm so grateful to both of you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Regent College podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, I'd really encourage you to share this episode with a friend.
And if you really liked it, then we would love you to go to your podcast provider and write us a review and rate the podcast so that we can reach even more people with the conversations that we're having here at the Regent College Podcast. Thanks.